You're listening to the final US election special of Midori House, first broadcast live from New York on the 7th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. So now we know. After a year and a half of campaigning, we're pretty much back where we started. Barack Obama is still president, Democrats still hold the Senate, and the Republicans still have the House. Hello and welcome to the final of our Midori House US election specials, live from New York here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Aisha Spears.
And yet, several things have changed. There are more women in the Senate, the first openly gay senator has been elected, and as Obama supporters maintain, his re-election is a clear victory for active government. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be analysing the results and asking what the next 4 years could mean for America.
42 men have stood before him, so what lessons can Obama learn from his predecessors, and where does his presidency sit in the bigger picture? We'll be putting these questions and more to today's studio guest, author and historian Kenneth Davis.
We'll be hearing from the celebrations last night at Obama HQ in Chicago.
It seems they love Obama. We'll also be taking a trip around the US one last time from Ohio to San Francisco to ask our network of journalists and editors how the results were received and what the next 4 years could look like state by state.
We'll pop over to Kenya too to hear how celebrations went down last night in Kegelo, birthplace of Obama's father. Plus, Julia Clark from Ipsos will be on hand one last time to deconstruct those polls and tell us what the numbers are saying about America today.
That's all coming up on this, the last of our US election specials, live from New York on Monocle 24.
But first, over to London to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
World leaders have been congratulating Barack Obama after he was re-elected for a second term as the President of the United States. Obama holds a 97 Electoral College vote advantage, with only Florida still to declare. The Florida vote for president was holding at around 50% for Obama and 49% for Mitt Romney. The Republicans have retained control of Congress, while in the Senate, the Democrats remain the majority party, gaining at least two senators and overturning Republican candidates with controversial views on abortion in Missouri and Indiana. Voters in Maryland and Maine have approved same-sex marriage, while a similar measure in Washington state appears likely to pass, marking the first time marriage rights have been extended to same-sex couples by the popular vote. Meanwhile, Barack Obama addressed a victory rally in Chicago, said the rival parties must set aside their differences and work together.
We can seize this future together, because we are not as divided as our politics suggests. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. We are, and forever will be, the United States of America.
In Kenya, the president's half-brother, Mustafa Obama, says the family was delighted by his victory. The US election has triggered a new generation of Barack Obamas and Joe Bidens in that country. Yuka Beth, a nurse at Nyanza General Hospital in Kisumu in western Kenya, says most parents prefer naming their children after people around the world. And it wasn't surprising to see them even naming their children Mitt Romney.
Traditionally, we find mothers name their babies after famous people, because even in the year 2008, during the same election year, some babies were named Barack, others were named Joe Biden, and so you find they tend to pick on people with big positions in the society or wherever.
Other news now, and a four-story building housing a department store in Ghana's capital Accra has collapsed, killing at least one person and trapping dozens inside. Rescue workers pulled at least six people from the rubble as large crowds gathered to watch. The Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu has said that NATO was preparing to deploy Patriot missiles on his country's soil. NATO member Turkey has already bolstered its own military presence along the 560-mile border and has been responding in kind to gunfire and mortar shells hitting its territory from fighting between Syrian rebels and Syrian government forces. The European Union Commissioner Olli Rehn has today predicted barely any growth for the Eurozone economy for the rest of this year, but says things will get better in 2014.
Market stress has been reduced, but there is certainly no room for complacency. Europe needs to continue to combine sound fiscal policies with structural reforms to create the conditions for sustainable growth in order to bring unemployment down and raise the rate of employment.
And finally, Italian shopkeepers in Naples began putting up their Christmas decorations today, like they do every year. But this year, the traditional nativity scenes contained a surprise. A proud-looking miniature of newly re-elected US President Barack Obama nestled amongst the sheep and baby Jesus. Most Italians say their own politicians don't count for anything, but Obama is special. Naples has strong historical ties with the United States. US forces were stationed in Naples at the end of the Second World War, and many Italian immigrants left the city to start new lives in the state. As a result, Neapolitans take a surprisingly very keen interest in US affairs. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. It is 18.06 in London, 13.06 on the East Coast. It's the morning after, the afternoon after the night before. And for the last time, we're live from New York. This is Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to a US election special on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Aisha Spears. Aisha, so it's over. We know who's won.
We think we know who's won, unless the Romney lawyers really get stuck in there and manage to turn something around, which I doubt they will. But yeah, we have a not so new president.
Indeed. Your highlight of the night?
I think we might share a highlight, which has to be the Karl Rove attempt to really turn around Ohio, to recount Ohio himself with some bits of paper, and seeing the Fox News hosts stumble their way down a hallway to the nerds in the back room who have said, actually, no, Karl Rove is wrong. So I don't think that's the last we've heard of Karl Rove saying the election was called wrong.
It was an astonishing piece of television. Essentially, Fox News called Ohio about 11:18 last night. 23:18 here on the East Coast, it's worth trying to find the footage of it, because you can see in their eyes, they're just dead behind their eyes as they announce that he's won. And then a few moments later, Karl Rove comes on, sheaf of papers everywhere, saying, "But no, it can't be right, because there's this county which hasn't been counted in that." And then they go and, as I said, speak to the geeks who say, "No, Karl Rove's won. Wrong. Obama's won." So that was your highlight, was it, or one of your highlights?
What was your highlight?
There was that. There was also, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, the same-sex marriage amendments, the election of the first openly gay senator, and also I rather liked Obama's speech. I know you weren't such a fan.
I think I'm a bit tired of the Obama rhetoric. I really wanted him to kind of come in and say something in a way that he hadn't said it before. Sometimes I feel like maybe I'm perhaps not allowed to say that because I don't actually have the vote in this country. But as a resident of this country, I do want to hear something different from Obama. Hope and change is great, but ending it on "this is the greatest country in the world" does always get me going, and is not the best thing for soft power.
That bit I definitely agree with. He lost me on "this is the greatest nation in the world." But the thing I did like about the hope and change was that it was, you know, hope and change is hard and you can still have it. But anyway, I thought that was good. But anyway, that was that.
In a moment, we'll be getting reaction from two familiar Monocle voices, Sasha Eisenberg and David Osborne. And we'll also be joined in the studio by historian Kenneth C. Davis. But first, Meredith Mandel was at Obama HQ in Chicago last night. This is what it sounded like.
Well, I feel definitely confident. I think that, as we see it come in, we're starting to see some states that we were waiting on, and I definitely feel excited about this. I feel like there's an excellent chance that, President Obama's going to be in for another 4 years.
Okay, Can you tell me a little bit about what you've done as a volunteer? I'm assuming you're a volunteer.
Yes, as a volunteer, I work with the West Side of Chicago with some of the grassroots campaign out there with Obama for America. And so I work with some field organizers out there doing great work with helping with the swing states, calling out to some of those swing states, working with the data, doing the reporting, and just kind of learning about how to get involved with the campaign. This is my second time I'm actually voting for the presidential election. So I'm really excited about it.
Larry Dixon, and I'm 57 years old.
Did you volunteer in the campaign?
Yes, I sure did.
Tell me what you did.
I worked out his campaign office in Oak Park.
CNN just said that he was going to win. How do you feel about that?
I knew he was going to win all along. I thought the media was actually making the race closer than what it was, just for some drama. I knew we had it in the bag.
My name is Sheila Carter from Chicago.
How long have you been volunteering for the campaign?
Oh my God, I've been supporting him since he was a senator because I live in his neighborhood. So I definitely, definitely support him. Senator, first time around and definitely second time around. It's definitely been worth it.
So tell me a little bit about, I guess they just projected that he's gonna win, CNN did. So hearing that, when you heard that, how does that make
you? Oh, I had faith. I knew he was going to win. It was just a matter of how many votes and how soon. I knew he was going to win. I had faith, never gave up. We kept dialing. He came by our office, and it was wonderful. So needless to say, divine order, divine order.
And they certainly do seem to love Obama. That was Meredith Mandel reporting there from Obama HQ in Chicago last night. We're joined now in the studio by Kenneth C. Davis, historian and author of Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Fortunately, he does. Kenneth, welcome. In 2008, it was obviously seen as a very historic election, the first ever African-American to be elected president. It was inevitable that when we looked at this election, it would be easy to say, well, it's not quite as historic. Is there an argument, though, that actually we saw something quite fundamental change in terms of demographics with the electorate here?
I think so, absolutely, that this night represented a historic change that probably began very much so in 2008 and carried through. But first, I must say that my first thoughts after this was were the words of another president in a different situation: our long national nightmare is over. that, of course, was Gerald Ford when he took office after Richard Nixon resigned. And I think a great many Americans share that feeling. I think we also probably have to think about that old expression about how it's not so nice to see how sausage is made when we speak of this election. The way we have elections and hold elections, I think, is going to be held up to further scrutiny after certainly some of the disasters that were reported around the country with polling lines 4 and 5 hours long. But to the main point, absolutely, we saw a change last night, and I think it was reflected when you looked back at the two conventions. When you saw the Republican convention, you saw a group of primarily older, whiter, wealthier people.
There was one black person. I saw her, and the cameras kept on cutting to her.
I'm sure they did everything they could. They also paraded up every possible non-white candidate they had on the GOP slate anywhere in the country. But to the main point, if you just took those two tableaus of the Republican convention, that sea of faces, and set it against the Democratic convention, they looked like two very different Americas. And the America that elected Barack Obama last night is that new America. It is younger. It is more of more color. It is of more language. And the Republican Party obviously knows, and they recognize this, that they are going to have to adjust to those realities of a very changing America. More Latinos, more African Americans, more Asians coming into the country and becoming part of the mainstream. This is not Dwight D. Eisenhower's America any longer.
It certainly seemed that Obama HQ had better music than Romney HQ last night, and that's certainly something which I think will get the younger people going. Kenneth, we heard both with what's going on in the Naples festivities for Christmas, as well as the fact that people love Obama in the sense he's a rock star. Across the world, he has this rock star image. Why do you think this is, and has any other president, perhaps other than JFK, really achieved that?
Well, the rock star image, it's hard to think of anyone recently that had that, although Bill Clinton certainly still has that, perhaps more so now after his presidency than during the most controversial moments of it. Bill Clinton, as he proved at the convention, can still electrify an audience, and he represents this split as well. I'm reminded, speaking of this notion of African-American presidents, that Bill Clinton was actually called the first black president by none other than Toni Morrison, the American novelist and writer, which was somewhat controversial at the time. She was reflecting on the fact that he came from roots that were very, very similar to so many young African-Americans, a single mother, kind of poor in a poor state, and I think she was reflecting on that, and it was a controversy at the time. But JFK changed the way the presidency looked forever in 1961. We had been used to a whole string of men in gray suits, the man in the gray flannel suit, and JFK and certainly his wife and children changed that. Barack Obama has transformed it even to a larger extent.
Kenneth, it's very easy to look over the last two decades and think, well, of course Obama was going to win because presidents always get re-elected. Bush was re-elected, Clinton was re-elected. But here's my one historical nugget. It's not my own. It was someone else mentioned it to me last night, that you have to go back to Jefferson, Madison and Monroe to find three consecutive presidents who have won two terms. Now, is that just a good pop quiz question, or does it actually tell us something?
That is a good pop quiz question, but it more to the point of incumbents who lose, and that question was being asked a great deal. There have been 19 incumbents, now 20, who have run for re-election and won. There are 10 who ran for re-election and lost. So it's a two to one difference, and that suggests certainly, first of all, that the power of the incumbent is a powerful one. The president can do things, as we saw here in the New York region and the metropolitan region in the wake of the storm last week. The president can be on the scene and can move ships around and do things that the other candidate cannot do. So that's a powerful, powerful piece of why incumbency is a big advantage.
Kenneth C. Davis, thank you very much. This is a Midori House U.S. election special here on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be in Chicago and Washington for reflections on the campaign.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts, and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
Sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24. is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
It is 18:20 in London, 13:20 here in New York City. We're with Kenneth C. Davis here in the studio. And also we have on the line for the final time for our Midori House specials, David Usborne, who's in Chicago, and Sasha Eisenberg, who's in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both. Sasha, I want to start with you. In Obama's speech last night, he mentioned a couple of things that he hadn't really mentioned a great deal on the trail. He talked about climate change in a way that It was just a mention, but it was there. He also talked about the possibility of immigration reform. Do you think, when we look ahead to what the second Obama administration might look like, that these will be two big issues that he might think about tackling?
Yeah, I think he might think about tackling both of them. I think you're probably more likely to see progress on immigration than on climate, in part because I think Republicans are going to look at the demographics in the results of this election and be entirely spooked about their performance with Latinos and look ahead at even the population growth in that community in the next 4 years and feel that seeing themselves on the wrong side of many Latino voters and the national Latino media is not going to set them up to be competitive nationally. And so my guess is there'll be a lot of senators who will be inclined to support some sort of reform package that they might not have looked at otherwise. And I wonder if this will be a moment where we see some version of an Obama-McCain collaboration that McCain sort of comes back into the fold on the immigration negotiations, and that opens up a lot of other Republicans to come along with him.
David, it seems that the economy and tax resolution still really is kind of the most pressing issue. Fox this morning really loved talking about the fiscal cliff that Obama will face in his second term. The Speaker of the House is set to hold a press conference this afternoon, I believe, to talk about how he sees this is going to happen. Do you think that this is going to be another long period of locked horns between the House and the President?
Yes, of course it is, I'm afraid. Part of the... They're trying to do a number of things at once, and among them is dealing with the expiration at the end of this year of the George Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. Now, President Obama campaigned very vigorously on the notion that it's time for the wealthiest Americans to pay a larger share to deal with the deficit, to deal with the debt. And so he needs to press that home. That's part of why he got elected. And you better believe it that the Republicans, embittered by their defeat last night, will again resist. On the other hand, I think as Sasha was intimating there, the Republicans have to make up their minds exactly how they're going to go forward now, whether it is wise for them to play the same game that they've played over the last 2 years of blocking Mr. Obama wherever they can. They may calculate that in the long term, it's in their better interest to accommodate the president. But even if they do that, there's going to be a bloody battle between now and December the 31st and all the euphoria and the thrill. By the way, I just watched the president go down the streets of Chicago here in his armored limousine, and instantly the pavements were lined with people cheering and waving. But that euphoria is going to vanish pretty quickly, I fear.
Kenneth, I want to bring you in here. It's very easy for presidents to say, or their supporters to say, in a second term, he doesn't have to be re-elected again. He's free of the shackles. He can be bold. It doesn't always turn out like that, does it?
No, it doesn't. And to the first point about this fiscal cliff, this is actually something that has to be dealt with before he's even inaugurated for the second term. So there's a really short window where they have to address this
question. The fiscal cliff, for those who don't know, is the fact that there's a certain number of tax cuts that will automatically come in at the end of the year. And some spending cuts as well.
Very, very draconian tax cuts and spending cuts will come into effect unless Congress and the president reach some compromise before a deadline in January. And then, of course, it will go into the next 4 years. But to the question of the second term, it's been somewhat sketchy. If you think back in recent history, for instance, Lyndon B. Johnson's second term destroyed by Vietnam, Richard M. Nixon destroyed by Watergate, Ronald Reagan's second term really pulled down by the Iran-Contra affair. fair. So second terms have a little bit of sketchy history where sometimes presidents run into some trouble. I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen here. It's just not, this is not unicorns and ponies for the next 4 years.
Sasha, we've heard a lot about the women's issue in both campaigns and very opposing views in both campaigns. And now we have the first all women Spice Girls of New Hampshire to be elected.
Don't call them the Spice Girls.
The brainy Spice Girls. And there's girl power going on across the country. How do you think this is going to play out, and how are we going to see the women's issue resolved, if at all, over the next 4 years?
You know, so the New Hampshire thing isn't as anomalous. I mean, you look at upper New England, and it's been something of a sort of Scandinavia of female representation in the legislatures. Maine has had a sort of similar arrangement for years. I think, you know, elsewhere in the country, I think it'll now be 20 out of 100 senators are women, the majority of them Democrats. I'm not sure that changes the tenor of it all too much. I think that, you know, there will be a number of big debates sort of within the Republican Party on where they may have overreached this year. And I think that there definitely will be a faction that says that social issues were a problem. It was unusual, I think, that in 2012 that we ultimately have the social fights not on gay marriage after the president changed his position on it, which turned out to be a non-issue all year, surprisingly, but instead on reproductive issues. And my guess is that there will be some pressure within the party to sort of back off those fights. But the problem with the shrinking party, whether it's on the fiscal stuff or on immigration or on abortion, is that sort of the fewer people you have, the more likely that the people who have short-term influence are sort of single-issue activists. And so it's unclear who will be in a position to push them aside.
David, I want to bring you in here. It's often said that America is a center-right country, and it's not just people on the right who say that. Democrats say that too. And yet what we've just seen is a president who promised tax rises for the wealthy being re-elected, a president who came out and supported gay marriage being re-elected. We saw the possibility of immigration reform, as we've been discussing. We've seen senators who said some quite horrendous things about rape and abortion being thrown out. Who perhaps would have got away with it 20 years ago. Is America now a center-left country?
No, I don't think so. I think America is just a country as polarized as it was before this whole election started. I mean, it's pretty clear. You mentioned all those things, and Barack Obama was pushed across the finishing line by what you might call the new progressive coalition in America. To that extent, something has changed, because that coalition is growing and becoming more important. And I mean women, I mean younger, educated people. Of course, I mean minorities. Hispanics were absolutely vital to success. And this is the foundation that the Democratic Party can build on. The Republicans, you know, Mitt Romney got almost 50% of the popular vote. But their coalition is perhaps a shrinking one, if you characterize it as rural voters, as blue-collar, mostly white Americans. It's right now an extremely angry coalition, a very strong coalition, but I think it's a shrinking one. So moving forward, and to answer your question, maybe that will come about. Maybe there is some kind of, if not leftward shift, then towards a progressive shift that I think bodes well for Democrats in the future. And Republicans will now have to decide whether they instinctively move to the right to combat it, or whether their best bet is to move themselves a little bit more to the moderate center.
David Osborne in Chicago and Sasha Eisenberg in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for joining us. Just finally, Kenneth, I want to bring it back into the studio. We've heard a lot about partisan politics, and perhaps it's because of the media coverage, or perhaps it is because the two parties are more divided than ever. How do you see that? Is this really the most partisan we've seen the U.S. leadership?
Certainly not. 152 years ago, we were so partisan, we killed off 2% of the population. So that was truly partisanship.
So this is progress, then.
Yeah, we were a long way from being divided. Certainly, when I was growing up in this country and getting ready to vote for the first time in 1972, the country was far more divided over Vietnam. People were fighting in the streets. We're a long way from that. We have some very fundamental disagreements. On the other hand, I would say that this election took some of those disagreements off the table. Gay marriage seems to be, if not settled, it's certainly moving in a direction away from where it had been.
And so just on that point, that's happened very quickly. Because 2004, Karl Rove was saying this is a wedge issue, let's get gay marriage amendments on the ballot, and this will help us beat Kerry.
And remember that it was Bill Clinton who introduced the Defense of Marriage Act because he wanted to be seen as socially more conservative when he was in the struggles in the 1990s. So that's been an enormous move in a very short period of time, but I think it's speaks also to a very transformative generational moment. Younger people, especially, stay out of this. This is not my business. Run the government. Get us jobs. Get us education. But leave us alone with the things we want to do. And I think even the marijuana legalization bills, even as off center as that might be, speak to that a little bit.
Kenneth C. Davis, thank you very much indeed. The book is Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. The website is don'tknowmuch.com.
Thank you
very much for coming in today.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be asking how the election results were received in Kongelo, San Francisco, and Ohio. We'll deconstruct the polls with Julia Clark and ask Chris Smith from New York Magazine how the city is looking forward to its next election.
But first, back to London, where Jonathan Wheatley is waiting with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. World leaders have been congratulating Barack Obama after he was re-elected for a second term as President of the United States. The Republicans have retained control of Congress, while in the Senate, the Democrats remain the majority party, gaining at least two senators and defeating Republican senatorial candidates with controversial views on abortion in Missouri and Indiana. Other news now, a four-storey building housing a department store in Ghana's capital Accra has collapsed, killing at least one person and trapping dozens inside. Rescue workers pulled at least six people from the rubble as large crowds gathered to watch. The Turkish foreign minister has said that NATO was preparing to deploy Patriot missiles on his country's soil. NATO member Turkey has already bolstered its own military presence along the 560-mile border and has been responding to mortar shells hitting its territory from fighting between Syrian rebels and Syrian government forces. And the European Union Commissioner Olli Rehn has today predicted barely any growth for the Eurozone economy for the rest of this year, but says things will get better in 2014. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. This is the last of our Midori House election specials here on Monocle 24. I know, I'm really sad. Coming live from New York with me, Aisha Spears and Steve Bloomfield.
Now, as we heard yesterday, the small village of Kogelo in western Kenya, birthplace of Barack Obama's father, also called Barack Obama, was in rather high spirits during the election. And Nairobi correspondent Tristan McConnell was there. He's now back in Nairobi. Tristan, how was election night Kenya style?
Election night Kenya style was long and noisy. There was a lot of anticipation the night before, a lot of drinking, dancing, loud music, went on till about 4:30 in the morning. So we didn't get a lot of sleep because by about 7 o'clock, CNN, which is the channel everyone was watching at the guest house, announced that Barack Obama had won, and immediately the dancing started again, the music started up again, some of the drinking started again, And, you know, everyone was having a good time. I mean, the thing to bear in mind here is, you know, people don't, in a place like Kogelo, most people don't have their own televisions in their own houses. In fact, most people don't even have electricity in their own houses. So there tends to be a sort of communal gathering around, you know, a kind of public space. So that's where we were, and that's where the first celebrations kicked off. From there, it moved to Barack Obama's grandmother's house, which is a few minutes walk away. And again, plenty of dancing and jubilation going on. And Granny Sarah, as she's known to everyone in the area, gave us a few words congratulating her grandson, saying how proud she was. And it was a, you know, it was a joyous time, but it didn't last long. I mean, I must say, within, you know, an hour or so or a couple of hours, life had kind of returned to normal in the village. So I think what that kind of reflects is that, you know, obviously people are proud that someone who has relatives in a place like Kogelo has scaled these kind of dizzy heights of being president of the United States of America. They also understand that, you know, this doesn't actually have a sort of impact on their day-to-day life. It doesn't change Kenyan politics. It doesn't change life in Kogelo Village, not really. So there's a kind of realism there that goes alongside it. But, you know, nonetheless, clearly people were very proud, very happy, and it was a good excuse for, you know, a bit of a party and a bit of a good time to be had.
One final crucial question, Tristan. 4 years ago, one of our journalist colleagues who was in Kogelo brought along with him a goat named John, which he handed over to the Obama family for a celebration. Was there a goat called Mitt this time around?
There wasn't, but what there was, in fact, was a bullfight. This is a kind of traditional thing that goes on nearby, close to a big forest called Kakamega. It's quite a strange old ritual. They basically feed their bulls on a kind of mixture of food that includes quite a large quantity of marijuana, and then they set them to fight each other. And this year there was a fight between a bull called Barack and a bull called Mitt. And I believe, if my information is correct, that Barack did win. But no, there were no goats called Mitt taken to the slaughter this time.
The first election coverage, I think, probably to talk about bullfights. Thank you very much, Tristan McConnell, our Nairobi correspondent.
Now, this is Midori House on Monocle 24. We're in New York City, where last night we watched the US presidential elections results roll in. Everyone said it was all going to be about Ohio, and last night the state went to Obama 51-48.
Earlier, we caught up with Emily McCord, news director for WYSO Public Radio in Ohio, to hear how the night played out in her state.
Here in at our station in Ohio, we were really focusing on the minutiae, the sort of what was happening precinct by precinct in Ohio. Surprisingly, we found out earlier than I think a lot of us thought we would find out. At the very beginning, they counted the early votes first, and it seemed like Obama had kind of a wide margin, but we knew that that was going to start to slim down as some of the election day results started to trickle in, and indeed, that is exactly what happened. At 11 o'clock, when we wrapped up our broadcast for the live coverage here, we still thought there would be a very long night ahead. By the time I ran home, I realized, oh, the president had been elected. So that had happened by 11:30. Ohio had been called for President Obama. And of course, once that happened, the other walls started to crumble for Mitt Romney. And President Obama was the winner last night, gave his speech around 2 o'clock in the morning.
Emily, it seems that it might have been the federal bailout of the auto industry that kind of gave Obama the edge in Ohio. How do you feel about that? Obviously, there was a huge decline in manufacturing jobs there, and Romney came out on top in terms of exit polls for how he handled the economy for voters, but they still seem to back Obama when they were thinking about jobs.
From what I'm hearing, I think that it's safe to say that the auto industry certainly did play into this election. It affects 1 in 8 jobs, whether you're working directly for a factory, whether you're working for a restaurant that serves workers that work at that factory. It's a huge backbone of Ohio. And so I think that that has resonated a lot with Ohio voters. Lots of folks in parts of Northwest Ohio showed support for President Obama. And it does seem like that resonated with voters in a way that Mitt Romney, even at that late kind of play that he made talking about Jeep shipping jobs to China, that did not seem to detract enough to seal the deal for Ohio for him.
Emily, talk to us a bit about your operation at WYSO. How did you cover election night last night? How many people did you have out and about? How did it all work for you?
Well, we are a pretty small staff here. Full-time, I'm the news director. We have one other full-time reporter and then a part-time reporter. So what we did is we had assigned the two other reporters stories and getting election results as they have them, doing interviews for our morning broadcast. I was doing live two ways on the air with our State House News Bureau chief, and she was giving us updates on the presidential race. She was looking at the map, telling us precinct by precinct, where we were all sitting there thinking, this could be days, and instead we found out at 11. And so we also did analysis of some of our statewide local issues that were happening here as well. But, you know, the presidential race, it seems to be the most important thing. It's what people really are tuning in to hear. We did have some other important races, a Senate race of note here as well in Ohio, but we did focus a lot on the presidential race, giving updates, letting people know what was happening up until about 11 o'clock when we felt at this point that it was going to be a long night, that we were going to let the national network take it from there. And then, of course, it turned around in half an hour and they called it. But we were back on the air this morning at 6 a.m. with a bunch of results as well.
It's been a long day for you, Emily, and it's been a long few months for everyone in Ohio with a lot of political ads. I think at one point there were 16 in a row that were played in Ohio. How are you feeling about the fact that you're not going to have anything to distract you, like the entertainment of political ads for the next few months?
I think that there's honestly a collective sigh of relief around Ohio. I mean, it has been, there's just no, you're so inundated with it. Robocalls, mailings, the ads, seeing the signs on your neighbor's lawn, and all of a sudden, yeah, your neighbors are suddenly a political foe. It can almost lend to a toxic feeling sometimes, especially as we get to that fever pitch around the election. Hopefully now we can start to move forward as we know what has happened, kind of get back to normal. Of course, there are a lot of things on the docket that here in Ohio we're focusing on, what's going to happen next with the budget talks that are set to expire, the sequestration cuts that we're looking at here in Ohio. That's a big deal, and we're wondering how Congress and the president are going to work together to avoid that from happening. So that's probably where our next focus will end up being.
That was Emily McCord, news director at WYSO Public Radio in Ohio, talking to us a little earlier.
You're listening to a U.S. election special of Midori House. We'll be right back after this to deconstruct some of the polls for the one last time. Stay tuned.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
We're going to have to get some nicer stings just like that. I like that one.
What, to have your name in lights, basically, and radio equivalent of lights?
No. It's not because she's saying my name. It's just like,
it's
you know, it gets
you going.
It's because
she's saying
your name. It's perhaps like because she's saying my name. Welcome back. It is 1842 in London, 1342 here in New York. This is the final US election special here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Aisha Spears.
Just get your name in there one more time. Well, nearly every day here on these shows, we've been catching up with Julia Clark, Vice President of Public Affairs from polling group Ipsos. And I'm delighted to say she joins us on the line now to help us make sense of what happened last night. Julia, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you.
How true did your polling estimates turn out to be?
Well, I am always pleased to be correct. I have to say that our estimates were spot on. Florida proved the closest and the most difficult to predict. We were off by about a point and a half there. But in all the other swing states and Senate races and at the national level where we made predictions, we were correct, which is a great feeling and also a sort of a nice win for us number crunchers and the science behind the polling methodologies.
Julia, there's been certainly in recent weeks sort of increasing talk of a disconnect between people like yourselves, statisticians, people that deal with numbers and evidence, and journalists and campaign operatives who are like, ah, yes, but no, I feel it in my gut, and I know that actually Pennsylvania will switch our way, or those polls in Florida are just wrong. Do you think that some people's attitudes might change a little bit after an election like this, where it seems like all the evidence that pointed us in a certain direction before the election proved to be correct?
I think so, and I hope so. I mean, we're trying to do different things. The pundits and the operatives you're talking about are trying to generate content in many ways, and if they're an operative, they're certainly trying to create a favorable situation for their candidate of choice. A pollster is judged entirely on our accuracy. We are judged only by our ability to accurately predict an event outcome. And so most pollsters, or at least the good nonpartisan pollsters, don't have any skin in the game. We just want to get it right. And so that sort of is the divide in the objectives between the two groups. I understand why, you know, you get a lot of noise around whether these numbers are accurate and who's going to win. But I mean, we wrote a piece back in April basically predicting this outcome. So it doesn't come as a huge shock. And we're not the only ones. You know, there's been a lot of polls for a long time predicting this kind of outcome. And I do hope it does shift the debate back a little more in a scientific direction, in the sense of, you know, what we are doing is not voodoo science. It is not sticking a finger in the air. It is not, you know, talking to some of our friends in D.C. This is about doing polling of all Americans, treating the data in a way that allows us to make a model or a prediction about how an election outcome will fall. And that is a scientific endeavor. And so I do hope it is paid a bit more attention moving forward.
Julia, we know who the next president of the United States will be, and we know that the Republicans have maintained the House and the Democrats have maintained the Senate. But what other numbers beyond that have you seen that are particularly exciting?
I think there's a couple of interesting dynamics here. The most exciting part of this election, I think, was early voting. For the first time, the laws in a lot of states had changed to allow early voting. We saw about 40%, slightly higher, I think, than 40% in the end will have cast a vote before Election Day. That's an enormous number. And what we think that did was change a little bit the demography of a likely voter. It made it easier for people to vote fundamentally. And so you saw turnout modeling shift a little bit. I think it helps the Democrats, because the more people who vote, the more the Democrats benefit. But it means that you don't just have to turn out on the day. So if it rains or if it snows, it doesn't mean that turnout is necessarily suppressed as much. And so some of the data suggests that the early votes were very much in favor of Obama, and votes on the day were much more towards Romney. And so that mix of turnout is going to be really important for us to understand better moving forward, so we can adjust our models. Other things I looked at were the younger vote and the white vote. I mean, really, Republicans are supported now essentially by the white part of America, and minorities and women tend to break for the Democrats. And so I think what this will mean is as demographics are shifting in America and we are becoming a less all-white nation, if you will, we are going to see the Republican Party have to shift a little bit to ensure that their messaging and their policies are crossing boundaries across, you know, ethnicities and races, in order to bring more people into the fold, because certainly the demographic profile of America is shifting, and it's shifting away from the Republicans.
Julia Clark from Ipsos, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for all your stats updates over the past few days. Now over to the West Coast. While the presidential race was not necessarily a major talking point there, last night voters in California agreed to raise taxes by $6 billion annually over 7 years.
Well, to talk us through this and other measures on ballots in the state, we're joined now by our man, Alistair G, in San Francisco. Hello, Alistair. Thank you for joining us. So what were the big kind of propositions that were passed yesterday?
Well, what was interesting was one that didn't pass. In fact, the death penalty repeal didn't pass with around 52% of voters choosing to keep it. And the proponents of the repeal, as I mentioned, made an economic argument. They were saying that prisoners on death row cost the state $130 million more a year than sentencing them to life without parole. And in fact, the leading cause of deaths of inmates on death row isn't being put to death. It's suicide and illness, because they're just on it so long with such a lengthy involved appeals process. Anyway, the voters said no to that. What voters did say yes to of interest was repealing the state's infamous three strikes law, which used to mean that prosecutors could seek a 25-to-life sentence if an offender on the occasion of an offender basically receiving a third prosecution. And that meant that even if it wasn't that serious, they could be sentenced to 25 to life. There's an infamous case of someone who stole a pizza for their third offense getting this sentence. So that's out now, and that means that around 3,000 people who are currently subject to the sentence can petition for an early release, which is going to reduce the stress on the state's very overcrowded prison system. The proposition you mentioned, this this tax raise, is quite interesting because Governor Jerry Brown ran for office saying that he wouldn't raise taxes unless the people approved it, and they have. And it's a good job that they did, because if they hadn't, there would have been an automatic $6 billion cut to public services like education. So, in further news, there was a proposition that food containing genetically modified products be labeled as such, and that also didn't pass.
Okay, Alistair, one final thing I just wanted to ask about California. Obviously, it's a place where presidential candidates don't go to campaign, they just go to raise money. You're already hearing some Democrats in Congress last night saying that, if we'd put in a bit more work here, we could have won some seats, which would help sort of not tip the balance in the House, but certainly help there. Do you see that ever changing, though, when you have a situation where there's really no point for a president himself to go and campaign in California?
I mean, just to give you a sense of how little sense there is, how little point there is to campaigning. Democrats now have enough votes in, at least in the state races in California, to have what's called a supermajority in both houses of the state legislature, meaning that they can essentially minimize the Republicans' role and pass things like taxes unilaterally. So it's such a Democratic state, at least on the state level, and also in terms of who they vote for in president, that maybe there isn't much point campaigning here.
Alistair G, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to a US election special here on Monocle 24.
Van uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
18:51 in London, 13:51 here in New York. We're leading into the final few minutes of our week of special US election coverage here in New York.
While media attention over the last 18 months has been, of course, on the national election, much page space over the last week has been devoted to Hurricane Sandy. And in New York, focus will soon turn to the mayoral election of 2013. Joining us on the line now is Chris Smith, political columnist of New York Magazine. Chris, thank you for joining us. Despite all the major networks being anchoring their coverage from New York last night, I thought the city seemed pretty quiet. Do you think this is due to the context of the hurricane and possible election apathy?
I don't have any turnout numbers, any scientific handle on it. But when you went around the city yesterday, the turnout, the lines were enormous. And some of that was the fact that it's a presidential year, some that polling places were destroyed and combined in various neighborhoods. It was a weird mood, It depended a great deal on whether you're in one of the shorefront areas, the waterfront areas that took tremendous damage during the storm, or in other parts of the city that went on unaffected. New York is a Democratic city in almost Soviet-era proportions. it's embarrassing when the numbers scroll across the screen and people are winning congressional races with 95% of the vote. So, people here were generally euphoric about Obama being reelected. But, the storm has dominated so many lives here for the past 10 or so days that it was very prominent in everyone's actions.
Chris, when we look ahead to the next few years, there's a number of big races coming up which will gain attention outside of New York and this region. First of all, who's going to become the new mayor of the city here? Then you've also got the governor race in New Jersey, potentially Cory Booker against Chris Christie. And of course, when we look ahead to 2016, names like Booker, like Christie, like Andrew Cuomo are all being mentioned. Despite the fact that politics in this region perhaps isn't as competitive all the time as some people would like, the city and the region does seem to be producing some pretty good politicians.
Yeah, you know, comparing us to New Orleans and Louisiana is certainly a low bar to clear, but our governor and our mayor have done very good work here in the aftermath of the storm. Not perfect by any means. In the short-term election future in the city, while all the candidates will almost certainly be Democrats running for mayor next year, it's going to be highly competitive, and we now obviously have a gigantic new issue for them to talk about. How do you protect the city from natural disaster in the near future? So there are going to be a lot of arguments, and should be, about, you know, do we build seawalls? Do we move back from the waterfront? That kind of thing. And that'll be interesting. How Mayor Bloomberg performs in the recovery effort over the next year is also going to be significant in the mayor's race. One of the front runner at the moment, Christine Quinn, is very closely identified with the mayor. And, you know, whether the mayor does well or poorly over this next year and how Quinn reacts to that will be a major piece of the puzzle. Yeah, you know, 4 years from now, Cuomo and Christie could very much be presidential candidates. In some ways, Obama being reelected doesn't work for Cuomo, you know, another Democrat after two terms of Obama in office. Cuomo has helped himself a great deal, however, in his performance over the past 10 days after the storm. He's a real Paul. He's been very energetic out in all sorts of communities, Long Island, upstate, you know, changing laws to get people insurance reimbursement, deploying the National Guard, all the kinds of things that make a politician very popular. Christie's future, much harder to read. You know, he was on sort of a downward trend in popular opinion prior to the storm. New Jersey's been devastated, and, you know, while Christie's been largely sympathetic, I think, in responding to the storm, the state has a tremendous and awful recovery hill to climb. And how Christie does there, yeah, will very much determine his prospects.
Chris, I mean, in New York, we can very easily just look at our local politics and think that really is all that's going on. But how much do you think that the rest of the country are seeing what Cuomo's doing, what Bloomberg's doing, and how well they're doing it? I know there's been a lot of talk of Chris Christie and perhaps coming up against the GOP for his support of Obama in the response to Hurricane Sandy. But how much do you think that if these people will start running for office in the next few years, that the rest of the country will see what they've done over the last week and over the next couple of months?
Yeah, probably not much. Christie certainly had a higher national profile pre-storm. You know, Cuomo has strenuously avoided the national stage. Bloomberg belatedly endorsed Obama. You know, Bloomberg's obviously a big name for all sorts of business and other reasons. But even the work Bloomberg did with a super PAC over the final 2 weeks of the campaign, you know, it was about money. It was not about Bloomberg's personal endorsement, because politically, yes, people tend to be focused closer to home. So I doubt, other than in a sort of generalized, unfocused, mostly positive way, Cuomo, Bloomberg won't get much identified in other parts of the country with the storm. Christie's a different animal, and because of his profile pre-storm, because of his prominence with Obama when the president came to visit New Jersey. So, yeah, the Republican Party, where it goes from here, you know, whether it's infighting, whether somebody like Christie can emerge as a more moderate-ish figure, they got a lot to figure out.
They have indeed. Chris Smith at New York Magazine, thank you very much indeed. And also congratulations on the issue that you guys put out after the hurricane. It was fantastic. Not just the amazing front page picture, but the whole thing. That is the last of our Midori House US election specials has come to an end. Thank you to all our correspondents and guests from across America and around the world who have joined us over the past week or so.
Thanks also to everyone here at Argo Studios in New York for being such wonderful hosts, in particular Paul Ruest and Noriko Akabe. Our production team was led by Katie Bilboa and included Barrett Austin, Pauline Eiferman, Toby Hammond and Ben Jay.
The world's greatest democracy may have some problems when it comes to voting. Really, what's wrong with pencil and paper? It may also have some problems when it comes to campaigning. The amount of money and the less than transparent nature of its source is a problem that's only going to grow. But a man with a Swahili name, whose father was born in Kenya, has been re-elected president. His opponent conceded with grace and style. Gay marriage is now legal in four more states, and the angry vitriolic right has suffered the sort of defeat which should lead to some serious soul-searching in the Republican Party and a better America for everyone. So that's not too bad, is it? It's been a pleasure to cover this for you. From New York, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Aisha Spears.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.